This is the morning of January the 5th.
That's right.
And the President, Noyes, and Hillman present. We're going to resume now, and we're going to start approaching Lincoln. But we've got Pierce and Buchanan to deal with briefly. But you were making a remark, Mr. President, about Bruce Catton's comment on Stephen Douglas.
Stephen A. Douglas.
Well, the comment was, qualified the comment, his comment being that Douglas could have prevented.
Douglas was trying to get a compromise to prevent. And Douglas was the cause.
The Civil War.
Yes. And the cause one of the principal causes of the Civil War was Douglas's Kansas-Nebraska bill, which repealed the Missouri Compromise and the Compromise of 1850. Two of the direct causes of the war between states. Now, in the repeal of the Missouri Compromise, which set the slave boundary at the southern boundary of Missouri at 3630 all the way to the Pacific coast, the idea was that states coming in north of that boundary would be free states and those coming in south would be slave states. Well, Stephen A. Douglas was the author of the Kansas-Nebraska Bill, which repealed those compromises and caused the disturbance in Kansas and that part of the territory north of 3630 and was one of the direct causes of the Civil War. Douglas couldn't have succeeded in getting anybody to compromise with him on that account, particularly those who were interested in the South.
And you think Catton's interpretation there is historically inaccurate, not based?
That's my opinion. Of course, he's got a right to his opinion, but if you read his history very carefully, you'll find that Stephen A. Douglas, Kansas-Nebraska bill, was one of the principal causes of the war between the states, and he brought it about. He didn't try to compromise on it.
Just for a quick try, is it asking the impossible thing, what do you think were the main causes leading to the Civil War?
Well, the principal causes leading to the Civil War was always the fear of the South that they would be overwhelmed in the representation in the Congress of the United States, and that the industrial development of the North would cause their downfall. I think they were not justified in that approach to the situation, but you can look back on anything and decide what something should have been done that was not done that would stop the thing. Conditions develop, and you've got to meet them as they go along. And any Monday morning quarterback can figure out what ought to have been done after the fact is over.
If you were going on, Mr. President, to point that out, what the main causes were of the Civil War?
Well, the main causes, in my opinion, were the repeal of the compromises of the Missouri Compromise and the Compromise of 1850, and the free settlement of the territory west of the western boundary of Missouri, which brought about the difficulties on the border between Missouri and Kansas, produced old John Brown, who not only was a murderer in his own right in Kansas, but who went back to Virginia and tried to create a rebellion there and was finally hanged when Robert E. Lee was in charge of the proceedings, and that's one of the best things that Robert E. Lee ever did was to hang old John Brown.
In other words, you take John Brown not so much as a great abolitionist and a great humanitarian, but actually he was.
As a troublemaker.
He was a fanatic.
He was a fanatic and a troublemaker. He caused most of the difficulty on the border between Missouri and Kansas after the repeal of the Compromise of 1850.
Well, now, the slavery question as such was main cause, more immediate cause for fanning the passions and the antagonisms between the North and the South.
Brought about by the New England abolitionists. And if you read carefully read the history of Lincoln, you'll find that his idea was not to abolish slavery, but to save the Union. He made the statement that he would be willing to have the country half slave and half free if it would save the Union. He'd be pleased not to disturb the slavery situation if it would save the Union. And the only reason that he issued the Emancipation Proclamation was because he thought it was a military measure which would help win the war between the states and save the Union.
Well, but in their debates, Lincoln and Douglas, the essence of the argument ran along the proposition that Lincoln was making, that you could not have slavery in any state where the police were not employed to enforce it. That was, as I recall it, but Douglas, he had driven Douglas into a corner by getting him to take both sides of the argument to please both the North and the South, didn't he?
That's exactly right, and that's what they were both trying to do. And when Lincoln became president, he tried to do that too, but it didn't work because it was too late.
Well, now, sorry.
Go ahead. Excuse me. When you were saying that one of the principal causes of the war was the compromise business, or failure of the compromise business, could you be a little bit more specific in or rather generalize a little bit more about that? Why did that lead to?
Well, when the Missouri Compromise and the Compromise of 1850 were repealed, that threw the whole of the northwestern part of the United States and the southwestern part of the United States open to the decision of the people who were then applying for statehood, either to come in as free states or slave states, and of course that caused local disturbances in every single part of that territory. And it was one of the principal causes of the war between the states, and I'm very happy myself that Lincoln had the viewpoint that the principal thing he was elected to do was to save the Union, and he did it, even if it did cost a great many lives. The war could have been stopped by any further compromise. I think he's entirely wrong.
Well, now, actually, the agitation as between the New England abolitionists and a very vituperative press, and wasn't Ralph Waldo Emerson among the most outspoken?
Yes, and so was John Greenleaf Whittier and several others.
They really, all the intellectuals and the great literary names of that period.
Greenleaf Whittier, Barbara Fritchie, is founded on something that never did happen.
Well, then you had Uncle Tom's Cabin that came along by Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Harriet Beecher Stowe, and Henry Ward Beecher was her brother, if you remember. And Henry Ward Beecher had a great time with his position as a great preacher who had his difficulties in his own church with some of his lady members.
Well, now, Mr. President, just to get back to the sensitivity that was inherent in the North, but also in many parts of the South, about the whole slavery question. Every president, to some degree, was exposed to the problem, and they either turned their backs on it, but they couldn't ignore it altogether. It was present all the way through, was it not?
Yes, that's true. If Jefferson's suggestion at the Constitutional Convention that slavery should gradually be abolished after 1809 had been followed through, there wouldn't have been any difficulty on the subject, but the South became a one-crop organization south of the Mason-Dixon line, that's with cotton, and they had to have cheap labor to raise the cotton so they could meet the world market in cotton. That was one of the causes of the difficulty, and it had the people considered the suggestions that were made at the Constitutional Convention that slavery eventually ought to be abolished. I don't think there would have been any war between the states because it was an economic war more than anything else. But the abolitionists, of course, made slavery the issue in the war, and that's what brought most of the trouble.
Well, that's interesting. You say it was an economic war.
That's right.
And the intellectuals and the poets of the North really made the issue very sensitive because they were raising questions beyond this economic competition, in other words, human issues.
You find all the great men of the South, usually when they came to the end of their lives, freed their slaves, and they were all convinced that slavery was not right, but was an economic proposition so far as the cotton states were concerned.
Well, actually, Robert E. Lee freed his slaves even before he went along with that theory and freed his own slaves, didn't he?
That's correct, as did a great number of other of the great leaders of the South.
Well, that leads me to this question in general about revolutions and usually the doctrines which are enunciated by the so-called intellectuals or the intelligent class. I suppose that that has been the bane of existence of all governments that have been overturned or threatened by revolutionaries. This question of an appeal to what the rebels call a humanitarian, or to some issues above the ground issue.
But you know, there have only been two successful revolutions in the whole history of the world. That is the American Revolution in 1776 and the Russian Revolution in 1917. The others have all been failures.
That's interesting. Now, why has the French Revolution been a failure, Mr. President?
The French Revolution was a failure for the simple reason that the radicals got control of it, just as the radicals got control of the Congress of the United States after the war between the states and caused all the trouble in the South. And then it took a strong man like Napoleon to come along and settle the matter. But the French Revolution, at the time of its termination, when Napoleon took over the government of France, was a complete failure.
When you're talking about revolutions in that spirit, you're talking then about the great revolutions, not the revolutions of which may have taken the form of rebellion against a ruler by a small group of people anywhere at all.
No, I'm talking about the revolutions whose follow-up had an effect on the history of the world. And that's the American Revolution and the Revolution in 1917 with Russia. The rest of them didn't have any final effect.
I'd like to get back to a very important point you made a while back, in which you said that had the Constitution provided for the liberation of the abolition of slavery, the war of the states would have been prevented.
I think that's true.
Now,
I think that's true because it's economic.
Now, then the Constitution, in that sense, represented an unhappy compromise.
Yes, it represented a compromise which had to be made in order to get itself adopted.
Now,
and after it was adopted, then they worked under it until 1860, and then we had to whip ourselves for 4 years before we finally decided that's what we wanted. And today, it's the best document of government that ever was written.
Now, you've often referred to it as the best document that was ever written by man, and yet, one of the most tragic consequences of the document was the war between the states. They had anticipated a great many things that were hardly perceptible in those days, and yet, a problem facing them immediately, they sidestepped.
Well, there's another thing you've got to take into consideration. The Prince of Peace, who came to the world and established peace, has been the cause of more wars and more revolutions than any other man in the history of the world. If you take all the wars in the Middle Ages between the various sections of the European continent were brought about in the name of Christianity, which had no business to be entered into the thing any more than the economic situation had to be entered into our civil war.
May I end on that note on tape number one so that we can continue with the next tape? It's the end of tape number one, the morning of January the 5th. This is tape number two of the morning of January the 5th. You were just talking, Mr. President, of the many wars which took place in the name of the Prince of Peace. Would you continue that thought?
Yes, in the Middle Ages, when difficulties arose with the Catholic Church and the Protestants of Northern Europe, there were a great many people who were killed in the name of religion. It should never happen. And that's also what happened in the Far East when the Mohammedans came in. They were killing people because the Koran was the basis on which they worked, and they thought that they were worded, and they thought that, and the Christians did the same thing in Middle Europe. And Gustavus Adolphus, the great Swedish king, was fighting a war for the Protestants. He was helped along by the Catholic Bishop Richelieu, who was the man who ran the government, because Richelieu was very much afraid that the Spaniards and the Holy Roman Empire would put France in a bad position, so he helped Gustavus Adolphus. It's one of the most peculiar histories and studies that there is, one of the most interesting to find. We're killing each other because they wanted to get peace in the world, which they never did on that basis.
Mr. President, in that connection, I'd like to cite a bit of Hilaire Belloc in his book on Cardinal Richelieu says that it was the tragic fate of Christianity that a prince of the church was the first one to break down the Christian union in Europe in the name of nationalism, and that actually the prince of the church was the first nationalist because he was having to make France the big power.
Hilaire Belloc was a violent Catholic and was very anxious to make it appear that the Catholic religion was what Richelieu, the facts in the case are, Richelieu's final successor was the greatest prince that ever ruled the kingdom of France. And if he brought that about, he at least made a contribution to the welfare of the world.
And Hilaire Belloc was also an anti-Semite on the side, wasn't he?
That's right.
Oh, yes, but nevertheless, his book on the prince of the church had destroyed Catholicism.
Cardinal Richelieu was the prime minister of France, and he was doing his duty in his effort to make France the greatest nation of Europe at that time. And he substantially succeeded, I think.
Well, now, to get back to the tremendous conflict that was brewing almost from the very outset, as between the industrial North and the agricultural South.
Excuse me, Dave. Could you hold that a minute? We wanted to bring in the question Dave had in mind was with the opened up by the discovery of Columbus. And the mad rush, the Spanish king took precaution, Alexander the Third, and asked for authority so that he discovered Columbus was an Italian,
and he was very much interested in the fact that he wanted to prove that the world was round, and that the world was round. India, by sailing west as well as they could by going round the Cape of Good Hope through India, through the Indian Ocean, and he was successful in successful the northern part of South America. And on account of the fact that he was an Italian, the Spaniards always wanted to discredit him. Well, the Spaniards went ahead and settled Cuba and then South America. Cortez, an adventurer, took a few and landed in Mexico and destroyed the Aztec Empire. Murdered Montezuma and nearly all the great leaders of the Aztec Empire, and made slaves out of the rest of them. Pizarro did the same thing in Peru, where they had a very stable and very equalized government for the welfare and benefit of the people. He killed the Inca of the time by tying him up to a pole, one of the most cruel ways in the world, the mines for the gold which the Spaniards took back to Spain and dissipated it. Europe are most interested because they are brought back to Mexico by these butchers, working for their own welfare and benefit, not for the welfare and benefit of the Spanish Empire or of the people whom they conquered. I have no admiration whatever for either one of them.
Well, I wanted to bring in this point that as a result of getting agreement getting agreement with Alexander the Sixth, and many of the Spanish priests who would read in Latin to the Indians, who of course did not understand what was being read, this proclamation which enabled them in the name of the Pope to take over the land and people.
Call all the inhabitants heretics because they understand what the Indians understand. It's a terrible thing. And a blot on the Spanish occupation of the Western Hemisphere.
Probably one of the most cruel things in the history of the world.
No question about it.
Was this done with the knowledge of the Vatican?
Yes.
And it was, the order was issued by Alexander the Sixth. who fixing up a poison bowl for somebody else, drank it himself by mistake, and that's how he died.
Now, was this a French pope?
Was this
an Italian?
He was a
Borgia?
No, yes, a Borgia. He was a Borgia. Yes, a Borgia. Two Borgias, who were two Borgias, are all the people that married for his son and daughter. He was the Pope.
All right, now where was a Catholic country like France that was building an empire at that time, and where was the humanitarian Protestant nation of the British Empire?
Well, Francis the First, I think, was the King of France when Charles V was King of Spain and Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And that was at that time. They were endeavoring to establish a balance of power, which finally came about, I think, with the King Henry IV, who was the successor of the sons of Francis I. He had three sons who were kings, all Medicis. They were sons of Catherine de' Medici. And then the great English program came about under Elizabeth along about this same time, in that same period. In her war with the Philip II of Spain, who was the successor of Charles V, and the defeat of the Spanish Armada made the British kingdom a world power. Then a balance of power came about between France and the Holy Roman Empire and Britain.
Well, now, they were all, since they were all navigating, exploring, and seeking, this does not exclude the Scandinavian countries who were also very heavily engaged.
They were doing the same thing.
They were in early Vikings.
The Vikings.
In the records of either Sweden or Norway or Denmark, those show that these Norsemen finally arrived in Rhode Island, but the northern part of the United States was settled by the British. The Spanish in the south, and the French then finally settled in part of Canada and took over all the whole western part of the continent before they got through. And the Russians came in on the northwest corner of the continent and had Alaska and had claims as far down as San Francisco, California.
The discovery of America was in that sense. Since they were all shooting out in all directions at that time. Because it would have occurred in the normal navigational procedures they were all embarking on.
I'm sure it would.
Except that up to the time of Columbus, very few of the Western nations dared to navigate the sea because they were afraid they'd be swallowed up by monsters or go over
the edge of the world. Didn't know where they were going to fall.
So the discovery was not, in a sense, a happenstance.
It was not really a happenstance if you look at it historically over a long period, but it was brought about by the persistence of one man who believed that the world was round and who wanted to prove it. And his name was Christopher Columbus, and he never got the credit that he was entitled to.
Well, then the discovery did not relate itself to any particular
interest that any group of people had at that time of colonizing or seeking a new environment.
Not until Columbus had persisted and found it. Then they all wanted to colonize and take over part of it, Britain, France, and Spain.
Yes, but in addition, you mustn't overlook the fact, Dave, that the individual captains of ships or expeditions were going out not for purposes of colonizing, but for exploiting the gold and all the natural resources that they could tap. Natural resources being gold.
The Portuguese earned a lot of credit in that because Vasco da Gama, the first man, sailed around the African continent and they discovered those islands out west of the African coast, the Canaries and the what's the name of that other bunch of islands right there close to the Canaries. The Portuguese deserve a great deal of credit because the Portuguese settled Brazil and finally set up an empire in Brazil, which became one of the great republics of the Western Hemisphere.
Well, now, but something was as soon as the actual business of colonization began to occur on the North American continent, something began to stir in people, something began to stir in the settlers. What is it that was stirring them on to this ultimate new experiment that was undertaken?
Well, the northern part of the Atlantic coast from Maine to Florida was settled by Englishmen and Scotsmen and Swedes and Danes. And they finally became a part of the British colonial empire in the Western Hemisphere. And the French had that part of Canada, which is north of these former colonies. And in the French and Indian War, the English took over Canada, and then the settlers in Virginia and Maryland, which was a Catholic colony, and New Jersey and Delaware, which were Swedish colonies, and the New England part of the settlement, New York, which was a Dutch colony, finally became the British colonies. And the King of Britain was not very kind to them, and they finally organized a Continental Congress, which finally brought forth the Constitution of the United States and created the Republic of the United States of America, one of the great countries in the history of the world.
This was the end of tape 2, the morning of January the 5th,